Hey there, it's Tom Corson Knowles, number one best-selling author of the Kindle Publishing Bible Series and founder of TCK Publishing. Welcome to the Publishing Profits Podcast, where our mission is to help you turn your writing into a profitable career. In today's show, we have an incredible guest for you. Her name is Robin Hoffman. She is a successful entrepreneur, author, and writing coach. Robin and I both know that creating a best-selling book isn't just about marketing. It's about the entire writing, publishing, and marketing process. And it all starts with your very first book idea. You see, Robin has studied some of the most best-selling books in the world, the ones that have sold hundreds of thousands or even millions of copies. And she discovered that there are only four bestseller blueprints or book structures that all of these best-selling books used. You're about to discover exactly what these four best-selling blueprints are and how to use them to give your next book a better shot at becoming a bestseller. So grab your notebook and pen and get ready to take notes because you're about to learn how to make some serious publishing profits. Well, Robin, thanks so much for joining us today on the show. You know, I know you've had a lot of experience in the publishing industry. So tell us, you know, how did you get started in publishing in the first place?
Well, Tom, it goes back to the 80s, actually, when I was I studied journalism at the George Washington University, and I worked for the Washington Post as a news aide while I was in school, and I also worked for the school newspaper, the GW Hatchet, and I was an editor on the school's poetry magazine, and I did some freelance writing for the Post. And then the chairman of my department recommended me for a job with a number one New York Times best-selling author to become his research assistant. And, you know, he told me it's such a good opportunity that I think if you get the job, you should leave the Post to take it. And I thought, well, that's quite an endorsement because I really thought I'd found a sweet spot working at the Post. But I went to the interview and I ended up working for a gentleman by the name of David Wise, who has authored, I think by now it's over 14 books. And in the 3-year period that I worked for him, we worked on 3 books. One was a novel, one was a political science textbook, and the other was a nonfiction expose about a spy who sold secrets to the Soviets and while he worked for the CIA and then evaded FBI surveillance and escaped to go live in Moscow. So needless to say, it was a very interesting few years. And, you know, at the time, I didn't realize that I was getting my PhD in publishing. I thought that I was just learning some ropes and paying some dues on my travels towards a career in newspaper reporting. And it wasn't really until years later that I started to put the pieces together, and I realized that during that 3 years, I learned how to develop saleable concepts, the process of pitching, working with a publisher, working with editors, and all the way up through national publicity campaign. And so that was really the foundation of the knowledge and experience that years later I brought forward into creating this work of my own design. And, you know, in between that time, I built and sold a successful fitness business, and I did some writing while I did that. But I really thought, oh, I did skip a part. I did go work as a newspaper reporter for a couple of years. And after I sold the fitness business, I wanted to help people in a different way, but I didn't know exactly what that would look like. But I knew that people who own wellness businesses tended to not have a lot of business acumen. So I went to graduate school and got a master's in spiritual psychology with the intention that I would teach wellness professionals how to grow their businesses. And I completed my master's and I learned a lot of great skills about listening and really listening for the essence of what somebody's trying to say and not just the words, and really getting a deeper meaning in what they're trying to convey and reflecting that back to them. And I started taking on clients, and an interesting thing happened, Tom. My clients started to say, well, what I really want to do is write a book.
Yeah.
And and I, of course, said, yeah, I know a lot about that. And what ended up happening, if we fast forward, is I took my experience working on books with David back in Washington, D.C., and brought that into my knowledge of being a small business owner, and merged that with my training as a master's in spiritual psychology with how to ask questions and listen, and develop my practice as a book coach. So I help coaches and consultants write books to build their credibility, increase their income, and expand their impact.
That's awesome.
Here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know you've done a ton of research into, you know, what really makes a book a bestseller. I know that's really what your focus is with your clients, is, you know, helping them craft a bestseller, especially, like, you know, for new authors who, you know, don't necessarily have the skills to write a book, but they have all the knowledge and the expertise to share with the world.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that bestseller is an interesting term. I think it's really, you know, book sales is one piece of it, and it's also a book that, writing a book that helps to sell you and your expertise and your message. And, but interestingly, books that are bestsellers, also do that. So, you know, it's about being effective and communicating effectively with your audience. And I have noticed, and I think that one of the greatest signals that that's happening is being a New York Times bestseller. I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, exactly. That's what every author wants.
You know, that is the holy grail for authors. Is being a New York Times bestseller. And because of that, and my work with authors, I became very curious about, because this is the question I ask myself, is, okay, it's a given that not everyone who writes a book is going to write a New York Times bestseller, right? There's only 25 slots a week in each category that they list. So, but, what does it take to write a book of that caliber? Right? Because the actual sales numbers, there's a lot of other factors. There's how well known the author is, how well the book is promoted, you know, how, like, if it just happens to catch on, I mean, that can happen too, you know, if it's aligned with the stars and certain other events are taking place at the same time and the book happens to, I mean, there's all kinds of things that can lead to the actual making the list. But what I wanted to know is what goes into a book of that caliber, so that if the promotion was done up to par, and, you know, if the author was that notable, and or if the stars aligned, that that book would have the legs to stand on that list.
Exactly. And that's what I've noticed, that a lot of authors, they want that goal,
yeah,
but they're not necessarily willing to do that work and that research to say, you know, I want to make this the best book it can possibly be.
That's right. And it's like, you'll notice that there are certain traits that New York Times bestsellers have in common, that if you go and you kind of, you know, see the sort of average book that's floating around out there, they don't have those traits necessarily, mm-hmm. You know, not in every case. And so I look at it like, my question was, how can I help my clients write a book that's New York Times bestseller list worthy? You know, so that if they get the other pieces right, that book would be there and it would belong there. And I did. I found some interesting things.
Yeah, so tell us about your research. I mean, what did you find when you were looking at all these bestsellers and with all your experience?
Yeah, so one of the things I noticed, that I think we'll probably spend the most of the time talking today is that there are only all the New York Times bestsellers of present time, and I also check, and this holds true for all the best-selling books of all time since they've been counting. All these books were structured using one of only four basic blueprints. And I would think this would come as a tremendous relief to first-time authors especially, because I think one of the questions that people have, you know, is how can I structure my book? How should I structure it? And if you're just looking very superficially and you don't really know what you're looking at, it can appear that there are thousands of ways to structure a book. But I'm here to tell you today that, in fact, there are only four. And any other structure aside from these four is going to take you probably out of the running of a New York Times bestseller quality book. And if you use one of these four, you've just improved your odds.
Yeah, that's awesome. So tell us about these four bestseller blueprints.
Yeah, certainly. So I'm going to tell you about them in order of difficulty, because they're not all the same. Some of them are easier to write than others. And I'm also going to tell you a little bit about who should use each blueprint. Does that sound good?
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay.
Got my notebook ready to take notes.
All right. So, and by the way, can I tell you that my book is coming out in the fall? And I go into this in great detail in my book, but I'm going to give you an overview for today.
Yeah.
So, and the book is called How to Write a Book That Sells You. Okay, so having that out of the way. So the first blueprint, and the easiest to write, is I call the organized list. So the organized list blueprint is going to be mostly used for one of two types of books. The first one, and probably, actually they're both very, very common, but one way is to use it as a compilation book. So when you see a book that's a compilation of essays, such as Consider the Lobster by David Foster Wallace, or What the Dog Saw by Malcolm Gladwell, or anything by David Sedaris, Ellen Goodman, some of the popular essayists. But basically, it's a collection of essays or interviews or articles, and they're just all compiled in one place. And, one of the traits of the organized list, and this is true for both types of books, but I'll just tell you about it now, is that this book can be read in any order. So this is the book that you can open to any section and read, and then open to another section and read, and regardless of the order you read it in, you'll get pretty much the same value, right?
Is that one of the appeals of this? I mean, is that why this structure, tends to be on the bestseller list so often?
Well, it tends to be on the bestseller list so often, I think, just because it's a very workable structure. It's very easy to follow. Let me tell you a little bit about the other way it's used, and I think that'll clarify it too. The organized list blueprint is also most commonly used in self-help books. So, probably the best-selling example of an organized list blueprint would be Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Yeah, huge.
Where we see that there's an overriding theme, and then there's a compilation of contributions that reflect upon that theme. Another way that you see this blueprint used as a self-help book is, 1,001 Ways to Be Romantic, or 1,000 Ways to Promote Your Book, or 101 Ways to Whatever. So they're lists, right?
Right.
You're selling information in a list format that, you know, is more detailed than just a bullet pointed list. Usually these chapters for the self-help book are shorter and more numerous than not, but not always. The Four Agreements is an organized list.
That's a great book.
Yeah. It's a very clean, organized list. He has an introduction where he tells you the overview, and then he tells you each of the four agreements, and you could read the agreements in any order.
Yeah.
As long as you read all four, you're going to get the same value. So that's a really good example of a simple organized list. And Chicken Soup for the Soul is a good example of a more complex organized list.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what amazes me about the Four Agreements is that it's so short.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a small book, but it's so powerful. And out of all the books I've read, especially in the self-help genre, it's one of the most memorable for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's basically he's listing four agreements. And if you cut it down to its fundamental blueprint or structure, it's a list.
Well, it sounds pretty easy. I mean, now that I know that, it sounds really easy to write a book like that.
Right. And so the more complex version, like Chicken Soup for the Soul, you'll notice that there's like a subcategory, like love or spirit or whatever. And then under that, they have multiple entries. And so, but it's the same idea. He's just taken a bunch of ideas and organized them into a list. So hence the term organized list.
Gotcha. So what's next?
So the next blueprint, which is slightly more difficult to write, but still fairly easy, I call this the traditional outline blueprint. So this is the Roman numeral 1, ABC, 1, 2, 3. Right? Roman numeral 2, and then under that, ABCs, and then the subheads and the subheads. This book structure is best used for how-to books, step-by-step how-tos, and also can be used for self-help. Now, what's the difference between an organized list book for self-help and a traditional outline blueprint for self-help? The main difference is that in the traditional outline book, this book needs to be read in order. There is a method to the order in which the ideas are presented. So for a self-help book, you would introduce the simplest ideas first and then gradually add more complex ideas. But typically, the reader would need to understand the simple idea before they could grasp the more complex idea. For a how-to book, you would, of course, start with step one. And then move your way up through the steps. But again, it probably wouldn't make as much sense to the reader if they read step three before they read step one.
Right. So in this case, you're organizing everything from, you know, easy or starting point, you know, step one, and then all the way to the end.
That's right.
So this is a much, much more organized, you know, blueprint rather than just something that's a collection of essays or, you know, just.
Yeah. The order in which the information is presented is more significant, is significant when in the organized list, the order is not as significant.
Gotcha.
So a great example of a traditional outline blueprint for a self-help book would be Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He starts out with the most simple idea and then works, you know, which I think is like do what's important first, right? Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the book, you're reading about different quadrants and, you know.
Right.
Life. But I mean, you wouldn't want that to be step one, you see, or chapter one.
Right. It's so complex and it doesn't really draw you in the same way as a simple idea.
That's right. It starts with a very basic idea, moves up, and moves you through. Nine Steps to Financial Freedom by Susie Orman would be an example of the step method. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to start with step, you know, usually there's some introduction to sort of create a framework of what we're going to talk about and why, and then the book goes into the steps. And then, you know, there's often a conclusion or something, you know, some sort of guidance as to what to do after they read the book. Mm-hmm. But this is the outline that you learned when you did your term paper for high school, if you completed that.
So, yeah, it sounds familiar. It sounds like homework.
Yeah, pretty basic. But, you know, just realize that you don't have to write like you wrote for high school anymore. And actually, when you're writing for the mass market, you want to try to be a little more entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, well, most of the best-selling books I read in, you know, self-help in that genre, you know, they tend to either be funny or quirky or sexy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something unique about each author and their voice. It's not like boring academic textbooks.
Exactly. When you're writing for school, you actually get rewarded for taking your voice out of it.
Right.
But when you're writing for the market, you get rewarded for bringing your voice in. So that's a nice thing about it. And that's true of all the blueprints, by the way. You want to bring in your personality. And, you know, let's never forget one thing, that, you know, you're writing a book, you're sharing information, but understand something, and I'm sure you'll get this with your business. The number one business you're in when you're writing books is entertainment.
Yeah, for sure.
And if your book's not entertaining, I don't care how good the information is, it's going to be a lot harder to get that information shared. So, you know, it's great to include a little humor and flavor and, you know, any blueprint you use, I encourage people to find ways to get story in your book, even if they're just little short examples of your clients or your own experience. But people learn through story. They remember stories much more than they remember information. So you'll notice that's another trait of the New York Times bestsellers, is even the business books, the self-help books and the how-to books, they all are loaded with stories.
Absolutely. It's a great way to explain a point and to show, you know, real life examples of, you know, this is what happened to Susie, and she, you know, had this issue, and now she's using the strategy, and now her life is so much better. You know, it sounds a lot better than just, you know, just facts.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Which brings us to the third blueprint.
What's that?
This blueprint is, in fact, the best-selling blueprint of all time, period. But it doesn't mean everyone should write using it. As a matter of fact, most people would probably be better off in the organized list or the traditional outline. But the next blueprint is the story arc in three acts. So this blueprint is the one that's been used from Homer's Odyssey all the way up through Hunger Games and every story in between that ever was successful uses the arc in three acts.
Now we're talking about fiction.
Not necessarily. This also applies to memoir.
Okay.
It applies to nonfiction. Historical narrative. It applies to expose, like All the President's Men,
mm-hmm.
A nonfiction book that read like a novel about the Watergate scandal and the investigation of Woodward and Bernstein that uncovered it, right?
Right.
That book is a very true story that reads like a novel. Memoir should accomplish the same thing. Your memoir should read like a novel. It should be that engaging and that, you know, and like you're telling a story. that is interesting to people. So this, what I find my clients, you know, who tend to be in the coaching field or consulting or running their own companies or CEO of a major company or, you know, of a company, you know, sometimes memoir is a good venue for them. Another way this can be used is fable. So, you know, there are definitely some good examples of people who promote themselves as experts, inspirational guides in their field, who wrote fables like Dan Millman's Way of the Peaceful Warrior.
Right. Great.
You know, there was another interesting Michael Gerber in E Myth. He did an interesting thing. He took a traditional outline blueprint and wove in a fable.
Right, that's true.
About Sarah, the pie maker, you know?
Right.
So,
Ogmandino, I mean, his fables are huge.
Yes, exactly. So that's a good example of, you know, fable can be a great outlet for a self-help type writer. So the Arc in Three Acts is not just for novels. But since it includes novels, you can obviously see why, just in sheer volume of sales, the Arc in Three Acts has sold more books than any other blueprint on the planet. But also that proves the other point that I talked about, which is that stories sell.
Exactly.
So if you're writing a how-to or a self-help and you don't have stories in it yet, go back and put some in, because it will make the book more engaging.
Absolutely. So tell us about the structure. I mean, almost all writers know about the three-act structure, but, you know, let's just say someone's brand new. Can you explain
that? Yeah, I'd be amazed, you know. I just recently spoke at a writer's conference, and I asked the people in the room how many of them had never heard of the Arc in Three Acts, and I was alarmed at how many hands went up. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy to be there to have the opportunity to share, because I'm going to tell you right now, if you're writing a story, if you're writing a memoir or a fable or a novel of any kind, and your story lacks this arc, it will fail. And I know that sounds harsh, but there is no way that the story is going to work without the arc. Mm-hmm. It is literally the backbone for the story. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's in it. So Act One is what I call the normal. And usually you're setting up what's normal before the story really starts. So in The Hobbit, you know, we see Bilbo and Sam frolicking in the Shire, right? And then Gandalf comes to visit. Everything's normal, right?
Yeah.
Nothing wrong. So it's usually short, but we're getting a sense of the norm. Now, there are other techniques that you can bring in, and sometimes a technique is used where the reader is kind of shoved into the action, and then you go back and establish the Act One, and that's a little bit more advanced a technique, but it's certainly viable because the arc is still there, okay?
Right.
So I'm not saying you always have to start with a really peaceful Act One. I'm just saying that you got to be able to see the arc.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I picked up a novel the other day. I don't remember the name, but I was just in the bookstore, and I started reading the first chapter, and the first two pages, someone gets killed.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after that, it goes back to the backstory of why that happened and sets up Act One. And
exactly.
It was a great way to lead me in, because as soon as I started reading, I was like, wow, this is like already getting me in the action.
Yes, and that is totally acceptable. But you'll notice, like you said, that the author went back and gave you the context.
Exactly.
And so the Act One is really creating the context. And the Act One doesn't necessarily have to focus on the hero. The Act One can focus on the anti-hero as well. Mm-hmm. But what you're doing is creating, like, what's the normal? Okay, so then the next thing that happens on the arc is plot point one. And another way to describe this is the catalyst or the catalyzing event. So this is when something happens that changes everything. So if we go back to the Lord of the Rings, it would probably be when Bilbo puts on the ring at the party, right?
Yes.
And disappears for a second and everybody's freaked out, and then we start to see what the ring's about, and it attracted the horsemen, and all kinds of hell starts to break loose, right? And then they have to, you know, begin the quest. So that would be the catalyzing event. But you'll notice every single story, I don't care how small it is, there's a catalyzing event. Or how simple it seems, you know. Jack was supposed to sell the cow's milk, and he sold the cow for a handful of beans.
Yeah.
Catalyzing event. You know, Dorothy gets knocked out by a tornado. You know, Jack and Jill went up the hill.
Yeah.
Catalyzing event. So, every story has one. You need to find the one in yours. So if you're writing a memoir, I strongly encourage you to pick a time in your life that you're going to focus on, or a specific series of events you're going to focus on, and identify what these points are before you start writing. What was the moment that changed the trajectory of your life for that period? That's your plot point one. Okay, now, between plot point one and act two, there's going to be several other plot points. Each plot point represents one of two things. Either the protagonist is getting, or the anti-hero, you know, is getting closer to their goal or further away. Because usually the catalyzing event also includes a goal of some sort. Something you want to get done, or something that you want to stop from happening, or something that you want to discover. But there's going to be some quest, some goal, and various things will happen that will either get you closer to it or be setbacks. So, you know, it can be any number of, I mean, I think a great example of this is the Wizard of Oz, right? Like Dorothy goes and lands in Oz, and she wants to go home. That's the quest. And so then we see all these different things. You know, she meets some friends who want to go on the journey with her, so that, you know, they point out the yellow brick road. She follows that. But then she gets drugged and falls asleep in a field of poppies and gets kidnapped. And so all of these are plot points. And I'm just using these examples because I'm figuring these are books that, or movies that most of the people are probably familiar with.
Right.
But they apply it, you'll find it in any story. So, Act 2 basically begins at plot point 1. And all the other plot points are part of Act 2. So Act 2 is going to be the bulk of your book. At that point, at some point, you're going to reach the all is lost moment. Now this is when it appears, usually it happens right after the character thought they were going to succeed. And then not only do they not succeed, but it's even worse than they thought. So, good example, Wizard of Oz. Dorothy escapes the witch, finds the wizard, gets into his little workspace, and finds out he's not a wizard. And he doesn't have the powers that everyone thought he had. That's the all is lost moment. Because now Dorothy's like, I'm stuck in Oz, right?
Right. So you're taking this reader on this journey where they think, oh, it's about to, you know, the hero's about to get everything they wanted.
Yeah,
and then, your expectations are crashed.
Boom. Everything falls apart. And interestingly, by the way, it's really one of my favorite things about this story arc is you start to realize it does actually show up in our own lives, right? I mean, how many times does this happen? I know this happens to me almost every time I set out, on a goal and I want to go to a new level and, you know, I'll have victories and setbacks along the way. And usually the worst setback is right before the breakthrough, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, Richard Branson even has a term for it. He calls it the dip.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it reflects in our real lives as well as in fantasy. And that's one of the things I think is really cool about it. So the all is lost moment. At that point, the character presses on or not, but the climax is really right after the all is lost moment, and that's when we find out, is the hero or the central character going to succeed or not? It's the turning point where the fate is determined, right? So either you were about to reach your goal and you quit, or you press through even with all that adversity and got to the next level and woohoo. So obviously in a lot of stories the hero prevails, but not always, and you certainly have the choice depending on what you're wanting to create or what your characters are leading you to do. So Act 3 is basically, we get to see the resolution and what I call the new normal. So the old normal ended with that plot point one, with that catalyzing event. And obviously the characters went through all these different changes. And then, there's a new normal, which is, you know, things go back to normal, but they're not the same. So, you know, in All the President's Men, for example, when, you know, the end of the book is basically the stories were all published, Nixon resigned, and Woodward and Bernstein went back to being newspaper reporters, but definitely on a different level than when they started. As you know, not as city desk reporters, and they went to national, you know, renowned national reporters. So
I mean, I've had a lot of authors, you know, when they're first kind of presented with this three-act structure, and they're told that, you know, every story has to fit this structure, you know, some authors find that really limiting. You know, they think, you know, I want to be creative, I've got my own story to tell, like, why do I have to fit in this structure? So can you explain why? No, it's not necessarily limiting, but it's actually empowering to understand the structure.
That's such a great question, Juan. I'm so glad you thought of that because, you know, there's an interesting thing about creativity. And creativity flourishes inside a structure.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
If you question that, I would have you let's think of it this way. Would you rather listen to a 2-year-old bang on a piano because they're totally free and they're just feeling what they're feeling and they just are enjoying the moment of banging on the piano? How long do you want to sit and listen to that? Or do you want to listen to a master who's probably practiced scale for 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
You can't play improvisational jazz until you learn a C scale on a guitar or whatever instrument it is you're going to play.
Right. You have to learn the structure first. The fundamentals, the foundation.
There's a structure to how music works. If you play only dissonant notes together, no one wants to hear your music. There, any art form you pursue, there are fundamental structural rules that make it work. And if you choose to ignore them, you know, well, you're on your own, really, because there's a reason why those structures are there. Because certain notes do sound better together. And, I mean, just how long would you tolerate sitting there unless it's your own kid? Even then, like, you could maybe listen to a kid banging on a piano for, you know, up to 3 minutes before you want to, you know, cut your ears off. But you could listen to someone who respected the structure and went into improvisation literally for hours. You could completely lose your sense of time listening to that person. But underlying all of that creativity is the structure. That's what I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, think about like an architect. You know, another great metaphor for it, because, you know, you look at Frank Lloyd Wright and his amazing buildings, but, you know, he wasn't just creating like crazy, you know, statues. I mean, he's creating actual houses based on, you know, the fundamentals of the profession. And he did it in a really unique way, but, you know, his houses still stand up. You know, that's the
thing.
There
we go. They wouldn't have ever stood if he didn't respect the laws of gravity and the structure, the fundamental structures that make buildings stand up.
Exactly. And because he had mastered those fundamentals so well, he was able to create something totally new and totally unique.
Yeah. And you know, this is something that goes back to, like, I really believe that you cannot there's no way to get too good at the fundamentals. Yeah. Like, whatever you want to pursue, I mean, and I've done acting, singing, dance, guitar, anything I've ever studied, I always respect the time spent on the fundamentals, because it's really, that's your access point to the great flourishes of creativity, is mastering those.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all about mastering the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. And you know, once you've mastered the fundamentals, if you want to consciously break a rule, I mean, because let's face it, I mean, to be totally honest, I can think of one author who has ignored the Arc in Three Acts and become a New York Times bestseller, and that would be David Foster Wallace. But he's a very particular taste, and I don't think anyone listening to this call would ever, I mean, literally, like, we're talking somebody who's got, who mastered the basics to such a level that he could afford to break the rules and get away with it. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you, we're talking about not even a 100% of writers that you'll find that can actually pull that off.
Yeah.
So.
Let's stick to the fundamentals. Master the basics.
I mean, he wrote. Yeah, he wrote plenty. He had plenty of success writing within accepted structures before he went off the map like that.
So tell us about the fourth best-selling blueprint.
Okay, so the fourth blueprint is the essay, and I actually think this can be one of the more difficult to write, especially when your entire book is an essay. Because remember, we talked in the compilation book, you know, one way to do this is a compilation of essays, and it's not terribly difficult to write a short essay. But when you're writing an entire book that's basically an essay, it can be more involved, because you're going to have to probably do a lot of research and interviews. Because really, the essay blueprint is designed specifically to prove a point, or to bring some new information to the public that they didn't have access to before. So usually this type of format is going to be designed to convince and create a new paradigm. So like Diet for a New World by John Robbins would be a good example, where he provides all this evidence of the damage that we're doing to the planet by the way that we eat. Mm-hmm. And then he provides suggestions of, you know, different ways different approaches we could take that would mitigate the problem, right? But he has a lot of research on the food industry and, you know, certain companies in the food industry. And, you know, his book was actually one of the groundbreaking books on, you know, some of the issues we're seeing now with the food industry. But anyway, also this book, you know, Al Gore's Life in the Balance about global warming would be a good example. Candace Pert's Molecules of Emotion. You know, these books are designed, usually they're written by journalists or researchers, because it's usually people who have in-depth knowledge of a particular area, and Freakonomics is another one, where they're bringing to light to the public a new perspective or new information to help the public make new decisions or to raise their awareness, you know?
Right.
But like I said, not for the armchair expert. I mean, these are usually carried out by not only researchers, but researchers with teams or, you know, journalists who are, you know, that's their job, right? Is to know that information and write about it. So, or authors who got big advances to take time off to write. Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point is a great example, right? He brings forth a new theory. Trends act like epidemics. And then he presents all kinds of evidence. And that's what the essay, you know, you have a hypothesis, you present your evidence, and then you wrap up by saying you proved your hypothesis. So that's the essay.
Right.
In that form, there's another way to do the essay that's a bit more accessible, and that would be like the personal essay, where you use a story or stories from your own life to illustrate a particular point that you want to make, or an observation that you're making about life or society or the world or whatever. And that can be a very, very effective means for a consultant or a coach type person who wants to share about their perspective in a more personal way and connect with their client or potential client that way.
Can you give us an example of a book like that?
Well, examples of books like that go back as far as like E.B. White and Emerson. and, you know, one of my favorite recent examples, although she didn't use it to become a coach, but Nora Ephron's I Feel Bad About My Neck, it's a great book. You know, what I would say is like the most popular books that you see written in that way are usually written by people who are known for something else, usually writing. Or philosophy or something. Mm-hmm. But an expert can use that format, but I haven't seen one do it and become a bestseller with it yet. But it's a viable blueprint, and there's, you know, the real difference between those books becoming bestsellers or not is just how known the author is, how well known the author is. But it does require a little bit more writing chops, you know, because you have to be able to tell a story and then what I call from the double witness perspective, which is on one hand, you can see the, you're in the story and you're putting the reader in the story. And then you also have this perspective where you're coming out and sort of taking a witness perspective and explaining it from that place and giving perspective. And so that's why I have it on the later part of the list, because it does require more writing skill than the organized list or the traditional outline.
Yeah, but you have to be very objective. You have to be, you know, a very skilled writer. And then, I mean, like, look at Malcolm Gladwell's books. I mean, imagine the research to go and the Tipping Point or Outliers. I mean, like, years and years of research you're talking to write a book like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're more of an undertaking. I mean, I do have some clients that I, you know, have recommended that blueprint to, but usually they're running an organization and they have a team that can help them with the research.
Gotcha.
So I'd say most of my clients either are writing the organized list, the traditional outline, or the memoir or fable. Those are the most popular for people who own their own business, or, you know, are a CEO, or, you know, a consultant or coach. All those are excellent choices for people in those situations. Mm-hmm. And then the other one would be the compilation of personal essays. That also shows up sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. So how are you and your clients using these best-selling blueprints? I mean, you know, now that, you know, the authors listening, you know, understand these structures, you know, how do you recommend, you know, a new writer or a writer who hasn't yet had their breakthrough, how do you recommend they use, you know, these structures to really take their next book to a higher level?
Yeah, I would say, well, the first thing is figure out, you know, what is the book concept that you plan to write? Because, like, if you already know you're going to write a how-to book, then just use the traditional outline blueprint and be done with it. You know, like, don't, just, that's the blueprint.
Yeah.
If you know you're going to write a self-help book, you know, I mean, I have another assessment tool, which we definitely won't have time to go into today, but, you know, you can actually choose a blueprint that suits your author personality or kind of the way you naturally relate to information. And anybody who wants to learn more about that tool, you know, I would say that you can find out about that at my website, getpublishedcoach.com. And, you know, just go there and you can fill out a contact form and tell me you want to know about the author personality assessment. But really, you want to look at, well, what's the book concept that you're writing? And choose the blueprint that matches it. Like, if you know you're going to write a memoir, well, you need the Arc in Three Acts. Mm-hmm. So this can narrow it down for you. I would say, based on the information you got today, you'll probably be able to narrow it down to two possibilities out of the four. And if you want to narrow it down further, then it's really about how do you most naturally relate to information, and what's the concept for the book? And, you know, Tom, those would just have to be saved for another day.
Yeah.
Or you can read my book. It's all in my book, How to Write a Book That Sells You.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, before you go, can you just share maybe one last tip on, you know, outlining? Because I know that's a big issue for writers, you know, like, especially for first-time authors, you know, if they're writing a self-help book or something like that, like, how do you go about outlining a book for the first time, whether it's novel or nonfiction?
Yeah, you know, that is a great question, and I swear I'm not being evasive, but the truth of the matter is, It's different for every blueprint. So each blueprint has its own outline process. But, oh man, I'm afraid to even, I'm not, I'm trying to think of how I can give information without adding confusion, you know?
Yeah.
The starting point for all of them is to make a list of the ideas you want to cover.
Sounds simple.
And then what you do with that list, unfortunately or fortunately, but it's a little different for each blueprint. But that's the starting point, is identify what is it you're going to talk about, and then you want to start to look at the relationship between those points and see where they connect.
Gotcha. So you're basically starting off by just brainstorming. Yeah, these are all the ideas and
yeah.
points and stories I want to
yeah.
share. And then you're looking at how those pieces fit together.
Right. What you'll find is, like, you'll write down a bunch of ideas, and some of them are actually two different versions of the same idea. Mm-hmm. And some of them contain inside them multiple ideas. So, you know, the first thing you want to do is identify what those ideas are, what those events are, if it's your memoir. Mm-hmm. And try to find the through lines. But I know I'm being vague, but it's like literally like we have to come back for another hour.
Awesome. Well, we'll have to have you back on the show very soon.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's been a wealth
Thanks
of wealth of knowledge you shared with us. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Hey there, it's Tom Corson Knowles again. I hope you loved the show today with Robin Hoffman. If you'd like to contact Robin or learn more about what she's up to, just check out her website, getpublishedcoach.com. And if you want to get all the latest episodes and news about the Publishing Profits Podcast, join us at publishingprofitspodcast.com. Now stay tuned for next week's show where you're going to learn some writing and editing secrets to success from one of New York's top editors in the book publishing industry. All right, we'll see you next week on the show. Take care.